Hey everybody, we made it to Module 7, Visual Perception. So if this is the complete course on school vision for OT practitioners, it wouldn't be complete if we didn't talk about visual perception. Before we get started, I just want to say that visual perception can be kind of an overwhelming concept. It's really confusing. There are a lot of different terms, a lot of them overlap, and it can get pretty confusing. I don't want you to worry about that. I just want you to be able to recognize when something is vision versus visual perception and how we can use strategies to help the teachers, to help the kids, and how we can use strategies to help our students. I don't want you to get overwhelmed. I just want you to be able to recognize when it's a visual problem versus a visual perceptual problem and to have a whole bunch of really good strategies in your pocket for how to help your kids. One of the really important things that is often overlooked in the school setting when it comes to vision and visual perception is positioning. We do want to always check the way our children are sitting. Are they comfortable? Do they have a clear view of what's going on in the classroom? In your resource book, we've got a cool How to Size a Desk handout, which is a really good resource to hand out for teachers and also to use as a guide for when you're in the classroom, kind of scoping out what's going on with these certain kiddos. Are their desks sized okay? Do they have a clear line of vision of the teacher and of the board? We've also got a good handout from AOTA, which is tips for health and success in the school. So definitely be sure to check that out. When it comes to things that you're going to see in the classroom, I'm going to go back to this checklist, the functional difficulties of children with visual deficits. Some of the things in this list seem like they may be gross motor. Some of them seem like they may be visual perceptual. And sometimes you just have to use your clinical skills to tease it out. Nevertheless, this is a great resource for you to get a good idea of what's going on with your student in the classroom. I love checklists like this because they're quick and easy for the teachers to fill out, and they're easy for you to email to send to a teacher and gather some background information in case you need to do a screening or an evaluation. You have some good information right at your fingertips before you even get started. Sometimes we're asked to look at a kid's work sample, and right away we say, oh, look at this. The spacing is awful. It's definitely a visual perceptual issue. But you can't always tell. And as you have more experience in the school setting, you start to be able to realize like, well, it could be a visual perceptual issue, but it also could be a motor issue. And it also could be a vision issue. So that's why I feel sometimes visual perception can get a little overwhelming. When I look at this work sample, I see a lot of red flags. And I'm going to talk to you about how to spot red flags on your own. And I'm going to talk to you about how you can spot different red flags and what they might mean. When I was in school, we always talked about visual perception. I never heard the term visual information processing, but that is the new and improved term for visual perception. Does it matter if you say visual information processing or visual perception? Not really. But just so you know that they mean the same thing, there are a lot of different language and a lot of different terminology, and that can be confusing, especially for teachers. So you want to make sure that they understand what it is that you're talking about if you say visual information processing, or if they're used to using the word visual perception, then go with that. But basically, it allows us to process visual stimuli in the environment in order to identify what we're seeing and then understand the world that we live in and the environment that we're functioning in. According to the comprehensive three-component model of vision, visual information processing is one of the three components. And then visual information processing has three sections of its own. So again, this goes back to why it can be a little confusing. Visual information processing is an umbrella term, and it encompasses a lot of different skills. Many of them overlap, and many tasks that we give to our students incorporate more than one of these visual information processing tasks. So that goes back to why it's difficult. Like, is this child struggling with visual discrimination, or is it a visual closure issue? Sometimes it's hard to tell. And in all honesty, you don't always need to know exactly which piece it is, because they do overlap. So there are three main areas of visual information processing according to the three-component model. And they are visual spatial skills, visual analysis, and visual motor. I'm going to get into what each one of those categories really encompasses, and we'll talk about how it impacts the kids in the class. So visual spatial skills incorporates bilateral integration, laterality, and directionality. So when I first started learning about the three-component model of vision, this was surprising to me because I wouldn't think of bilateral coordination or bilateral integration as a visual skill necessarily. But then if you really think about it, it makes a lot of sense because it is spatial. If our kids don't know how to coordinate the two sides of their body together, or if they have a difficulty with laterality of recognizing left and right, that is spatial. And it would impact their motor skills that come from that. The child might be clumsy, they might fall. You may see difficulty with rhythm activities. I love to use rhythm activities with my kids, clapping games, and even things like trying to dribble to a metronome or having a catch and trying to do it to a beat. You will really see that a lot of our students that we work with struggle with this. And it can be a spatial thing. It can be a motor thing. Sometimes it can be both. It's hard to tell, but it's always great to incorporate those kinds of activities into what you're doing with your students to work on all the skills at once. These kids may have difficulty understanding left and right. I always tend to look at this when the kids are doing the Pledge of Allegiance. In the US, we do that every day in school, and they're supposed to put their right hand over their heart. And you'll notice, especially when the kids are younger, that's very normal and developmentally appropriate that they may be using their non-dominant hand, or they may be using the wrong hand to put it over their heart. But it does indicate that it may be a struggle for them to recognize their left from their right. Laterality and directionality is the ability to orient one's body in space and to perceive the positions of the objects in relation to one another. So while I think of puzzle skills, I wouldn't think necessarily of laterality and directionality, but that's really true. If we're putting a puzzle together, we've got to be able to recognize how things relate to each other, how they go with one another, and then also recognizing where our body is in space. And when we're giving kids directions, we use a lot of spatial language that they may struggle with. Maybe because of the language, but maybe because of the visual information processing. It, of course, can be hard to tell. But these kids have difficulty telling time. They may have a poor sense of time. They may read and write letters that are similar, like B and D or M and W, and get them mixed up because they really do look similar. It's a matter of flipping them, which can be tricky. And they're mentally flipping them, which can be tricky. They also may have difficulty organizing their work on paper. So you know those kiddos that don't adhere to the margins and don't have enough space for their math work? This can be a laterality or directionality problem. They may also transpose letters within a word. For example, reading left instead of the word felt, or spilt instead of split. That happens sometimes. They can get words in the wrong order. They can add or omit words when they are doing some expressive writing exercises. They may have difficulty lining up vertical sums correctly, and they may have difficulty with graphing activities. There's a lot that goes into this, and it can be hard to tease out. Bilateral integration, again, this is something that OTs, school OTPs are very familiar with, bilateral integration and bilateral coordination. But I would at first think of holding the paper in writing, or maybe cutting or tracing. And I would tend to think of it more as a motor skill, but it really is spatial as well. It's the ability to use both sides of the body separately and simultaneously. So whether they're doing the same task, so, you know, if they're rolling out the dough or something like that with two hands doing the same activity, or it can be something like one hand is holding and the other hand is cutting. Students who have trouble with this may struggle with gross motor tasks such as skipping, catching. They may have trouble going up the stairs in a reciprocal pattern. And you might say, well, wouldn't that be gross motor? It could be. That's why this is so tricky. But we're learning, right? The last area is visual analysis. And this incorporates the subcomponents of visual perception that we would typically think of. This is what, when I first learned about visual perception, this was what I learned visual perception was. So it's discriminating between little differences in forms or letters or pictures. It's finding things in a busy background, visual figure ground. It can be visual closure, which is your ability to mentally fill things in, or visual memory and visualization. Visual figure ground is the ability to separate a figure from its background. Our students may have trouble finding things hidden in a picture. They may have trouble finding things in their desk, their locker, and their crayon box. This, I always say and laugh that my husband has this problem because he can never find the milk in the refrigerator, even though it's right there. That's a visual figure ground task. And it's something that we use way more often than we think we do. And our students who struggle with this definitely have some trouble in the classroom. They also may have difficulty with crowded worksheets, teasing out what they need to pay attention to versus the like peripheral stuff that they could kind of ignore and they have a hard time focusing on the one thing that they need to be looking at. So another component of visual analysis is visual closure. And this is the ability to identify a figure when parts of it are missing. This has a lot to do with reading. So when our students are reading, they're not actually decoding and sounding out and filling in and looking at every single word and every single letter. As they become more fluent, their brain starts to fill in the pieces of what the word is. So students who struggle with visual closure may have trouble breaking up words into syllables visually. They may have trouble decoding unfamiliar words. They may have difficulty combining phonic combinations to build a word or separating compound words. They may struggle with fractions because they don't understand that two halves make a whole. They may struggle with completing a picture or a letter if they're only given a part. So we can see how this would really have a lot to do with the way our students are learning in the classroom. It's something that they're using all the time, visual analysis and visual closure. So here's a little fun task that I'm giving to you to take a look and figure out how are your visual closure skills. We've got three celebrities here with pieces of their faces missing, and I'm going to give you a second to see if you can fill in who they are. Take a guess. Three of my favorites. So then I also included some clues by giving you some unfinished words. And this would be similar to a crossword that our students may be doing, or even when they're trying to read and their brain has to fill in those words. Our first word would be celebrity. Our second word would be benefactor. Our third word would be scandal. And our last word would be Benjamin Button. So then on the left, we've got J-Lo. In the middle, we've got Brad. In the middle, we've got Brad Pitt. And then to the right, we've got Kerry Washington from Scandal. The last sub area of visual information processing is visual motor skills. And this is something that we are super familiar with. And it's kind of one of the reasons that occupational therapists are often sought out in the school setting, because our kids are struggling with writing and handwriting and possibly drawing and fine motor skills. So again, I wouldn't think of visual motor and fine motor coordination as being something underneath the sub umbrella of visual perception. But according to the three component model of vision, it is. So that was a lot of language that we just went over, right? I mean, there's so many different terms. So many of them sound alike. They are interchangeable often depending on who you're speaking to. And it can just be a lot. There are different categories and subcategories. And it makes learning about visual perception more tricky, if you ask me. I put together this presentation based on best practices for occupational therapy in schools, which is published by AOTA, to give you the exact definitions. But in the school setting, we don't need to be crazy about exactly what means what. It's just having that understanding, visually aware, visual perception aware of what it is and how it can impact our students in the classroom. Visual perception combines vision and cognition into one skill, and it's the process of using our eyes to receive the visual information, and then our brain makes sense of it. So right off the bat, if our vision isn't intact, our visual perception is not going to be great either. If our cognition isn't intact, our visual perception is not going to be perfect either. So that's an important prerequisite to know, that we do want to be aware of what our students' cognitive levels are, and we want to be aware of whether or not they've had a vision exam and if their vision is intact. Next, we'll look at red flags. This handout is in your resource handbook, and I think that it's a great handout for teachers. It's a great handout for parents to just kind of spread the word about what visual perception difficulties actually look like. So some things are not as they seem. Actually, 90% of students who have learning disabilities have visual perception delays. So that's a really high correlation of students with learning disabilities that are struggling with visual perception. And some of the things that you may see, or that the parents may see at home, or the teachers may see in the classroom, are listed on this red flag page. And they include puzzles, matching difficulty, difficulty sorting or sequencing things, difficulty following directions, attending and focusing, organizing their belongings, reading, spelling, phonics, copying from the board, writing reversals, and then transposing. And then we come back to that clumsiness and difficulty with motor skills. So again, a lot of these symptoms can look like something else. That's where our clinical know-how comes in, and we just are aware of what deficits our students are having in the classroom and how to help them. Academically, there's a significant link between visual function, visual information processing, and students' academic performance. Here are some of the ways we may see visual perception difficulties in school. In math and science, in life skills, in social studies, and in reading and writing, and in the entire school environment. But I kind of picked these pieces out because they're things that I've noticed stand out to me when my students struggle with visual perception. In terms of life skills, they may really struggle with following spatial directions, like put this on top of that, or first do this and then do that. Organizing their work might be difficult, and then understanding different fonts on a worksheet or on the board can also be a struggle. In social studies, understanding different fonts again, or the indications of different fonts. And what I mean by this is if we look at a map, very often like a city might be italicized where the country might be bold in capital letters. Students with visual perception difficulties might not pick up on these subtle differences. And that can really impact the way they understand what they're looking at and what they're reading. Scanning and graphing activities for looking at maps, doing lateral and latitude and longitude, or tracking their math skills for graphing can also be something that's a struggle. And then reading and writing letters and words without visual cues, such as having an alphabet strip on the wall or on their desk, can be a struggle if they don't have that guide. And the decoding and the phonics can be a struggle as well. And then in math and science, they may struggle to understand measurements, like what I said before about the fractions, not understanding that 50 cents and 50 cents make a whole dollar, or 4 quarters equal $1. That can be confusing for little kids. And if it's a visual perception difficulty, it can keep happening as the student gets older. So we talked about how vision and cognition come together to make visual perception. Now we are going to go even further into it, that fine motor coordination separately and then visual perception separately combine to make visual motor integration. So again, there's so much overlap in terms of what our students have to do in order to function in the school setting. It can be hard to tease out, but I find sometimes looking at it this way helps me understand, okay, so if their vision isn't intact or their visual perception isn't intact, it's absolutely going to impact their visual motor integration because those are prerequisite skills or foundational skills that go into visual motor coordination. Same with fine motor skills. If their fine motor skills are not intact, their visual motor skills are likely also not going to be intact. So here's some of the things we'll see in our students who struggle with visual perception when it comes to their reading and handwriting. Letter and word recognition can be a big struggle. Deciphering different fonts and reading script can be a struggle, or reading different people's handwriting. Organizing their writing and recognizing the top of the page versus the bottom of the page. You know how sometimes you'll notice that the white bar at the top of a sheet of loose leaf, the kids don't tend to see it. That can be a spatial organization issue. Writing on the lines can be a struggle. Spacing between their words or spacing between lines of text. Noticing differences in similar letters. Again, we go to the B and the D, which are just very similar, but facing different ways. And then differences in similar words like form and from, they might not notice, or like tick and tuck. They may be things that they struggle with on a spelling test. So here are some of my favorite strategies when it comes to reading and writing in the classroom. I love to have my students use a ruler or a reading guide to help them track when they're reading. I always recommend the teacher to change the color when they're writing on the board. So if they're writing, today is Friday, that could be in red, and then we have gym could be in blue, etc. This helps our students to track when they're not only tracking from left to right, but they're also tracking from a vertical surface to a horizontal surface and from, you know, from far to near. So there's a lot that goes into that, more than a teacher would ever think of. So it's up to us to kind of educate them gently about that, so that there's more going into it than just copying from the board. Very often I find that kindergarten teachers will say to me, oh, this student's really struggling, they can't copy from the board. It's not necessarily developmentally appropriate for a 5 year old to be able to do that at this point. They're supposed to be just learning how to make their letters, not doing something that's so much more advanced. So while many of the children can do it, and that's great, we need to be able to tell the teacher it's not necessarily a red flag or a delay. They're just not there yet. And developmentally, that's okay. It's kindergarten. And depending on how old they are, they have the rest of the year to catch up and to work on that skill. It's not necessarily something that should be expected of them from the very beginning of the school year. I also like to tell the teacher to have the kids keep a pencil or a popsicle stick in their workbooks. So if they pull out their math workbook every day after lunch, let's say, you stick a popsicle stick on whatever page they're working on, because then the next day when they go to open it, it opens right to that page and they only have to go one more page. This saves the teacher a lot of time in terms of running around and helping every single kid find page 53, for example. But it also helps the kids to kind of orient themselves like, okay, here's where I am. I need to go one page forward. I also like to have my students highlight the start and the stop sign on their red loose leaf or in their composition notebooks. If we have the kids who just struggle and they're kind of not adhering to the margins, their writing's all over the place, I have them take a red magic marker and highlight the red lines, the stop and start. You can do both red or you can do green and red, like go and then stop, and have the kids highlight it for the next 5 or 6 pages. And this will give them that visual guide without anyone needing to give them a verbal cue and just remind them. And hopefully after a few days or a few weeks maybe of doing that, it will start to kick in and it will become a habit. When it comes to older kids, providing graphic organizers to help the child to put their writing or their work together in a specific sequence can really make a big difference. So something like this hamburger graphic is one that I know my 3rd and 4th grade teachers like to use when they're having the children write a paragraph. They give them the outline of exactly how to do that. Moving forward, we're going to be using AI and programs such as Magic School, which will help our students to do this. But the old-fashioned way is to just have a graphic organizer and to make sure at the beginning of a lesson, remind them of what the layout should look like. So they're not kind of just going into it willy-nilly. There's a specific order and sequence that helps them space things out and organize things mentally. Using hands-on manipulative to demonstrate spacing between letters and words is a great idea. You can have the kids use toothpicks to put spaces between letters and then buttons to have them do spaces between words to help them to differentiate, okay, tiny space between letters and big space between words. This makes it a little bit more fun and also helps them to visually see that difference about why they need to leave the space and how much neater it is after they leave the space. For older kids, I love to use the signature post-it pads, stickies, because it's flat. It doesn't mess up their hand when they're writing, but also it's a little more fun because it sticks and they can move it over. It happens to be the perfect size of a finger space. And I find that they feel a little cooler using a sticky note post-it rather than using their finger when they need help with spacing. When it comes to handwriting practice, using crosswords and word searches for spelling assignments is a great way to teach letter size and the small letters versus the taller letters, depending on what handwriting terminology you use because of what program you use. But using boxes to space out where the letters go is a great visual guide of how to learn spacing and how to learn small, tall, and full, or lowercase versus capital letters can be helpful. And I like using word banks or suggesting word banks for my teachers because it helps the children to really recognize the length of the word and how it can fit into the boxes underneath. So this is a sample worksheet of something that I made with one of the fonts in my Miss Jamie OT shop. I have a box font, which you can type the letters or the words that you want the child to practice writing, and it will automatically come up with the correct size box. So that's kind of fun and just makes life a little bit easier for you to have things prepared. It's a great way to help teachers with their spelling lists or any kind of fun spelling assignments. Using word banks can be really helpful and word walls in the classroom as well. But the one thing is you have to also be careful that you don't go nuts with visual clutter. A lot of classrooms, when you walk in, it's like, wow, the bulletin board over here about graphic organizers, and then the word wall over here, and the job poster over here, and the whose birthday is when thing on this cork board. For children who get visually overstimulated, that can be a lot. That's another thing to kind of just be aware of. And it can be a suggestion if you have a kid who's constantly getting distracted by visual stimuli, it's something to be aware of that that might be one of the reasons. Adapting the paper is a great way to help children with spatial orientation as well. You can highlight or mark every other line on a regular piece of loose leaf to help out with spacing. You can draw lines for words or letters, depending on what the student needs help with. If they need help with spacing between words, then you draw a line for just the word they need to write, like today, leave a big space, put a line, is, leave a big space, Friday. But if it's for letters, if they're still struggling to figure out how to space their letters correctly, then you put a little dash for each letter, like T-O-D-A-Y, big space, I-S. I find that this helps kids just to get, where do the lines go and where do I place my letters and how far apart? So if you give them that kind of guideline, it really makes a difference. Raised line paper can also be a really big help for students who struggle. It can also help students with motor issues. So if the child has poor motor control, having that tactile feedback of raised line paper can really make a nice difference. Other cool tools from OT entrepreneurs that you can check out are Woo Tape, which is like a washi tape that has the lines on it. This is a great thing to give to teachers when they have a lot of worksheets that are pre-made that don't have lines on them. Our students with OT struggles and visual motor and handwriting issues, they have a hard time with unlined spaces. They really need that defined space. So the Woo Tape just peels off. You can stick it right on the worksheet and you can have a child have their own version of it, which would be in their pencil case. They may struggle with the motor piece of unpeeling it, but you can also give it to the teacher. And then the Legi Liner is another thing. It's like a reusable stamp and it comes in all different ways. You can have 1-inch spaces, smaller, like loose leaf lines. It comes with little spots for letter by letter. There's all different variations. It's a great tool. And you can just kind of glide across the paper and it puts lines on worksheets. So I have given that tool to a few teachers for my kids who really struggle with motor pieces. And I would say, like, I noticed that your math workbook really doesn't have any lines in it, and it's a lot for that teacher to go running over and make lines every single day or every single time. So to have this where they can just go voop is awesome. And they also can do that for things that they're about to photocopy. If it doesn't have any lines on it, they can do this on the master copy. And now the whole class has lines. Big help. Visual cues in the classroom are an awesome way to remind students about spacing. I taught my little daughter this trick about B and D, and she loves the alphabet song. So we'll sing it and I'll always show her like A, B, C, and D. So we put our fingers out and we learn how to figure out which one's B always comes before D. There's a poster of this in your resources handbook. It's a great thing to photocopy and give to teachers or print out and keep in your OT room when you're practicing handwriting skills. The reversal cue is another good one because we teach kids the B is the belly and the D is the donut, and that they're facing this way, again, similar to this, and then P and Q. I find these really helpful. And visual closure. I love to use letter stories to call attention to open letters. So for instance, if you have a student, if you look at the Q right here, like R-A-N, this student left the R open, the A open, and the N open. And I always will tease my kids and say that there's a dirt truck coming along. And if you leave your letters open, the dirt truck is going to dump dirt into those spaces and it will get all smelly and stinky and you make a joke about it and be like, you know, ew, oh my goodness. And of course they giggle and they crack up, but more importantly, they remember this cue and it helps them to kind of close up those letters, tighten it up, make it look a little more neat. The old-fashioned way and the old worksheets, and we still see it today, is tracing dots. This is harder for students than actually tracing over a highlighted line. Tracing and filling in those dots is a visual closure skill, and kids' visual closure skills are not completely developed when they're in kindergarten and preschool. Definitely not. And so we're presenting them with these incomplete forms, like the word trace. The T is incomplete, the R is incomplete, the A is incomplete. And our students may not have the cognitive ability to look at that and visually fill it in and recognize what letter it is. So what they do to compensate is they tend to kind of connect the dots. And that doesn't help with letter formation at all. In fact, it creates bad habits. I'm a big fan of highlighting. I like to write the word in yellow highlighter, or even if you're going to do it in grayscale on a Microsoft Word sheet or something like that, and have them write on top of that instead of tracing over dotted lines. When it comes to math, science, and technology, visual perception is everywhere. They're doing a lot of measurements, and I'm thinking specifically of our older students. In middle school, this is where the visual perception and the perceptual motor tasks in the academics really kind of step up. Our kiddos are using rulers, they're using protractors, compasses, they're using beakers, measuring, thermometers perhaps, all kinds of different things that require that spatial awareness. They're learning money, learning how to use decimals, understanding angles and percentages. This is really, really spatial. So we want to just be aware, if we're evaluating a student and they're really struggling in math, let's say, it's always a good thing to ask for their report card if you can, to just keep in mind that this could be one of the reasons why. They may struggle with noticing the difference in signs on their math sheets, like, oh, now it's a plus sign. I thought I was doing all subtraction. This can be a visual discrimination issue. Lining up their numbers can be difficult. Finding pages in their textbook, or even noticing differences in the text on their textbook. So for example, looking for a vocabulary word. Very often those important vocabulary words might be bold or highlighted or italicized. If the child doesn't notice the difference in that, it's going to be so much harder for them to do their work and to pick out those words that they need and answer the questions and finish their work. So they get frustrated, and we don't want that. So here are some strategies to try when you're seeing those difficulties. You want to teach the students to highlight all of the signs on their math sheets before they even start their work. Color coding important words such as gave to away when they're in word problems can give them that indicator that it's a subtraction problem and can be helpful. When it comes to math, using graph paper to help kids organize their numbers and place each number in one box, that can be helpful. Also, taking loose leaf, turning it sideways to help them with columns when they're struggling with spacing and alignment. That can also be helpful. Some other great ideas are to use hands-on manipulatives as much as possible for figuring out how things work together, understanding three-dimensional activities. Divide math pages into four squares with bold margins so that the kids realize this is for problem number one, over here is for problem number two. Even folding it and having them just work on that one corner can be helpful so their work doesn't kind of all smear across the page and into one another, and then the teacher can't see their work. Trying for an accommodation like less things on a page or less questions on a test per page. Masking is another really good, helpful tip. And you can do this with your student on their Chromebook. There are tools that you can use to do screen masking where the whole screen will be covered except for a small section. And this will help the students to keep their eyes tracking in the right area. But the old-fashioned way is to just use a piece of paper and cover up the rest of the page that they're not working on to decrease some of the visual clutter. That can be really helpful for our younger kids. For our older ones, definitely check out those accommodations on the Chromebook. Using color cues can be very helpful in terms of teaching measurement and fractions. The example up there on the ruler of marking off when the half is, like, so the student can understand this is 1 inch, this is 1.5 inch, make them different colors, and just to kind of reiterate understanding the different spaces. So it can be difficult to figure out, is this a visual perceptual issue? Is my student making progress? I'm not sure what's exactly going on here. But one thing you can do is looking at their math or their spelling or something like that and really look at, did they make a mistake because of a visual perceptual issue, or did they make a mistake with the math? So for example, on a worksheet like this, the student got 15, 4, and 16 wrong because of visual perception issues. They didn't notice that the symbol, the math problem, was a subtraction instead of an addition. The first problem on this page is an addition, and the student just plowed ahead, maybe because they were distracted, or maybe they didn't notice the change because of a visual discrimination issue. Regardless, they got the problem wrong because they added instead of subtracting. The other one, though, 4 + 4 = 9, that was a math issue. They did add, they just got the math incorrect. One way that you can tell if they're making progress is by giving students similar tasks that evaluate the same skill. So you want to track their errors, like I showed you before, as well as how many errors were due to visual perceptual issues. This works great for math and math sheets. When it comes to doing printables and things like that, you want to just be really conscious that you're using a good standard, that you're using the same task over and over again, even though it's a different task. Like, I love my visual perceptual workbook that I designed is specifically for this reason, because I needed something that was really consistent, but I didn't want it to be boring. Like, they're doing the same activity again and again. So it was like, I'm giving them a visual figure ground task once a month, but it would be a different task. One month it would be, you know, a holiday one, and the next one it would be a weather one, but it would be the same thing. So I could see how many were they able to find hidden in the busy background, and I was able to progress monitor that. So you really want to look for tools that are easy to progress monitor like that. Here's another example of a student, their spelling test. Most classes will have a spelling test every Friday or something like that. And this is a great way to differentiate. So if we look at what the student did, they had the S is reversed, the D is supposed to be a B, the S again is reversed, the D is supposed to be a B, and the S is reversed. So however you want to measure it, you can say they had 5 errors in 8 words, or you can say they had 7 3-letter words, which is 21 letters. They got 5 letters incorrect, 5 errors in 29 letters. It depends on how you want to do it. You pick what you want to do, but that's a good, easy way to progress monitor. And it's something too, if your teacher does this consistently, like they have a spelling test every Friday, this is something that you can do and go look at the end of the month at their 4 spelling tests and see how they did in terms of improving in their visual perception or improving on their reversals or improving on their spacing, whatever it is that you're progress monitoring. Including in your resources are some of my very favorite vision and visual perceptual toys. There are so many very cool visual perception toys out there, but keep in mind, you don't need a ton of them to work on the skills you need. It is good to have a variety so that you can keep things engaging with your students, but many of the toys or the tools that we have in our toolbox work on multiple skills at once. And using our creative OT brains is a great way to be thrifty, but also work on the skills we need. So in your resource pages is a list of my favorites. You're welcome to share it, give it to other OTs, or these can be great handouts to give to teachers, to give to parents at the holiday time, to give suggestions of really good developmentally appropriate toys that will help their students to succeed in school. So now we're going to start talking about some of the visual perception and visual evaluation tools that we may be using in the school environment. This is the visual skills appraisal 2. It's valid for students from 5 years to 14 years old, and it takes only about 10 minutes to administer, which is really nice. One of the things that I like about it is it's one of the few tools that's easy to assess visual efficiency. It also has visual motor subtests, so it works on more than one thing and gives us a good whole picture. It also only takes about 10 minutes to administer. So there's a visual motor component to this assessment, but there's not a straight visual perceptual component to it. So just keep that in mind. But this is a great tool. If you have any room in your school's budget to add a new assessment tool, this is a great one to look at visual efficiency. Here are some other really common visual perceptual assessment tools that we'll see in the school setting: the TVPS4, the DTVP, and the MVPT. I use the DTVP the most. Most of my evaluations are students from kindergarten to probably 5th grade. And I find that this test, the DTVP, is great because it's not super long and it has a visual motor component and a visual perceptual component without a motor piece. The TVPS is all visual perceptual and the MVPT is all visual perceptual. So on that note, this is a really important thing to consider. And I remember when I first learned this, I kind of had an aha moment of like, oh yeah, that makes so much sense. Here it is. In the US, we have 7.3 million kids who are classified as having a disability. These are kids who are 3 to 21. This data is from 21 to 22 school year, but I'm assuming this is not going to be changing dramatically, but it's interesting to know. So 32% of these kids have specific learning disabilities. 19% have speech and language impairment. So right there, let's look at 19%. Almost 20% of our students who are classified as having some kind of a disability are actually classified speech and language impaired. So right off the bat, we know that they have some language difficulties, right? Then we have students who have specific learning disabilities. That can be something like dyslexia, dysgraphia, anything like that, a specific learning disability. Many of those children also have speech difficulties. That might not be what they're classified as, but that doesn't mean they're not receiving services or that they don't have an identified deficit. So that means we have the 20% who are classified. Then we have more students who are not classified as speech and language, but do have some kind of issues. And then we have our students who are multiply disabled. Those students are also probably going to have speech and language impairments. And we could take everything that I just said and also tie it in with vision. Our students with multiple disabilities are probably or may very well likely have some kind of vision or visual perceptual difficulty. It doesn't mean that that's what they're classified as, but it can definitely be there. So we just need to be aware of that when we're choosing our evaluation tools. What are our students capable of? And just being aware of this speech barrier or receptive language barrier if our students struggle with language. So for example, a test like the TVPS, this is standardized for students from 5 to 21 years. They say it takes 25 minutes to administer. I find that it takes a lot longer. My students generally have attention issues. They may have difficulty focusing for long periods of time. So I tend to break it up. It has multiple subtests. I will space this out among different sessions, or I may do, if I'm doing an OT evaluation, I may do two subtests and then take a break and do some gross motor stuff so I can assess that, but also give the student a movement break and then come back and try to finish the assessment. I find this to be a little bit longer than 25 minutes for sure. I will most likely choose this for a middle school student or a high school student. I find it a little bit long. And what I really want to talk about is that it's very language heavy. So there's no motor component. The child doesn't have to draw anything or write anything. They're just looking at pictures and identifying which picture is the same as this, which picture is hidden over here, all these different things. But the actual standardized instructions, and I actually should have had it right in front of me and I don't, but the standardized instructions go something like, three of the pictures below are the same. One of them is different, but it could be bigger, smaller, darker, lighter, or turned on its side. For which of the figures is not the same? I mean, for our students with poor attention first, may not be able to listen to that direction to understand it. But then we have our students with spatial and language issues. They're going to struggle with that. So just keep that in mind when you're choosing an assessment. You really want to tease out, does the student understand what this subtest is? And most of these tests do have samples in the beginning, like the first two of each section will be an example, which is great because you can kind of see, does the student get it? But just try to also keep in mind, if they don't get it, why? The MVPT is another good one. I like this one for my elementary students. It gives more different areas of visual perception, but it combines it all in one score. So I like the TVPS because when you're scoring it, it will give you categories of they did this well in visual discrimination. They did this well in sequencing or something like that. And then you'll have a whole score. For the MVPT-4, it's just a whole score, but things are broken down into categories. So you can informally assess like, oh, wow, they really struggled with this section, but it only gives you one score. I tend to go to this one for my younger kids because I find it to just be a little bit faster. The DTVP3 is kind of my go-to. I find it much more comprehensive than the VMI. I really try not to ever use the VMI in an evaluation. I find that it's not very thorough at all. So the DTVP is standardized from 4 years to 12 years old. So that's our kindergarten to fifth grade kids, and you can use it in some preschool kids too. It takes about 30 minutes to administer. What I really like is that you get a visual motor score, a visual perceptual score, and then a whole composite score. I like that one a lot. And that's from Pearson Clinical. So sometimes if you're doing an evaluation and you choose a tool that doesn't have any visual perceptual component, for example, the BOT3. There's no visual perceptual component of that test, but we can't ignore our students' visual perception. We need some kind of a gauge to show that you looked at it, number one, but number two, how are they functioning in that? So in cases like that, you can take a subtest of a different test. For example, the visual perceptual subtest of the VMI. It is extremely quick. It's only 3 minutes. So it's not a great gauge of how your student's visual discrimination is, but it can be something that you add to your OT toolkit if you need just to look at the visual perception and you want a standardized score. However, this test only looks at visual discrimination. So just be aware of that. The MFUN is another one that has straight visual perceptual subtests. Now, this won't give you a visual perceptual composite, but it will go into a visual motor composite. And these are two simple subtests that look at visual discrimination for children 2.6 years old to 7.11 years old. So these are two subtests that you could pull out from the MFUN if you needed to specifically look at visual perception. So we just went over a bunch of visual perceptual assessments. There are a lot. There's a lot to choose from. There's a lot to think about when you're choosing the right evaluation tool. The most important thing is to remember when you're looking at a kid's visual perception, you've got to look at their vision first. Remember the image that we showed. If vision and cognition make up visual perception, if their vision isn't intact, their visual perception is not going to be intact either. So be aware, be vision aware. Make sure you take a look at that. One thing I just want to really reiterate, when it comes to visual perception, vision, being an OT in the school setting, it is so important to collaborate properly with the teachers. I know we just went over so much language and it can be overwhelming. And if it's overwhelming for us, we've got to realize that it can be kind of overwhelming for a teacher as well. So we want to kind of monitor our language heavy speak and just talk about spatial awareness so that we're using language that the teacher can relate to and understand. It's so important that we collaborate to have that carry over into the classroom and at home. We want to really look at how is this weakness impacting the child's academics? How is it impacting their functional skills? And we need to be aware that no one person is the expert. When you're really collaborating with a teacher in the classroom about a certain student, you're teaching each other what you know and just integrating all of that knowledge. So you're learning how the teacher is looking at it through their lens, and they're learning more about how you're looking at things in your lens. And the result is that it helps more children in less time, which is exactly why we're in the school setting to start with. So just keep that in mind. Collaboration is key. I also want to remind you that you've got resources in your workbook specifically about visual perception. We've got your how to size a desk sheet because you want to always look at positioning. We've got your functional behavior symptoms of difficulty in vision kids. And we've also got your AOTA occupational therapy tips for health and success. And lastly, we've got the red flags for visual perception handout and our best visual perceptual toys and games. So take a look at that, check it out. I think you'll find a lot of things that you really like. Talk to you later.